Hello and welcome to the IFRIC Update podcast for September 2014. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB, and I'm joined today by Akemi Miura, Koichiro Karamuchi and Denise Durant to talk about some of the matters that were discussed at the September 2014 IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting. The views that you'll hear today will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the IASB. Now, the committee met on the 16th and 17th of September 2014, and one of the issues that it discussed related to one of its existing interpretations, IFRIC 14. Now, that interpretation deals with or interprets IAS 19 and deals with the limit on a defined benefit asset and minimum funding requirements and their interaction. Now, at this meeting, the committee was discussing an issue that it received relating to this. Akemi, could you briefly describe what the issue was?
Yes. The Interpretations Committee received a request to clarify the application of the requirements of IFRIC 14 in relation to the availability of refunds from a defined benefit plan managed by an independent trustee. The Interpretations Committee discussed this issue at its May and July 2014 meetings. Specifically, it discussed a question about whether an employer has an unconditional right to a refund of surplus in the following circumstances. The trustee acts on behalf of the plan's members and is independent of the employer. The trustee has discretion in the event of a surplus arising in the plan to make alternative use of that surplus by augmenting the benefits payable to members or by winding up the plan through purchase of annuities or both, and the trustee has not exercised such a power at the end of the reporting date.
Now, Kimmy, you mentioned that the committee had discussed this previously at the May and July meetings. What direction did its discussions take in those meetings?
The Interpretations Committee discussed this issue at its May meeting, and the staff reported this issue to the IASB members in informal meetings. Some IASB members thought that the entity does not have an asset because the entity does not have control over the surplus, insofar as the trustee can prevent the entity's access to the surplus by using the surplus to enhance the benefits. At its July meeting, the Interpretations Committee considered these informal feedbacks received from the ISB members and discussed this matter further. At the July meeting, the Interpretations Committee noted the difficulty associated with assessing the consequences of the trustee's future actions and their effect on the entity's ability to estimate reliably the amount to be received by the entity. Consequently, a majority of the Interpretations Committee members observed that no asset should be recognized in this circumstance. However, some Interpretations Committee members were concerned about the consequences that this conclusion could have on the accounting for a minimum funding requirement and the consistency of the conclusion with the requirement of IAS 19.
Okay, and so these two concerns that the committee members had were the subject of the discussions in the September meeting. Where did the committee get to with these discussions?
At this meeting in September, as a result of its detailed analysis, the Interpretations Committee noted that there would be no conflicts between its conclusion at its July meeting and the requirement of IAS 19, because the application of the asset sharing requirement is separate from the determination of a surplus or deficit under IAS 19. It also noted that the conclusion should lead to consistent results when a minimum funding requirement exists. On the basis of the analysis and the previous observations at its July meeting, the Interpretations Committee thought that amendments to IFRIC 14 should be proposed to make clear some points. First, the amount of the surplus that the entity recognizes as an asset on the basis of a refund should not include amounts that the third party, for example, the plan trustees, has the unilateral right to use for other purposes, for example, by enhancing benefits for plan members. Secondly, an entity has an unconditional right to a refund of a surplus if no third parties can refuse an entity's request for a refund of a surplus in one or more of the three cases described in paragraph 11 of IFRIC 14. However, an entity does not have an unconditional right to a refund of a surplus, assuming the gradual settlement described in paragraph 11b, if a third party can unilaterally decide to wind up the plan and thus can prevent the gradual settlement. In addition, the Interpretations Committee concluded that amendments should be proposed to make clear that the trustee's unilateral power to buy annuities without changing the pension promise is the power to make investment decisions, and thus is different from the power to wind up a plan with settling plan liabilities or the power to use the surplus by enhancing benefits. And when a plan amendment or settlement occurs because of a decision by the trustees, a gain or loss on settlement or past service cost should be calculated and recognized in profit or loss in accordance with the existing guidance in IS 19. And an entity should reassess the asset ceiling, and the adjustment to the asset ceiling should be recognized in other comprehensive income, as required in paragraph 57(d)(3) of IS 19.
Okay, I think one of the key observations there that the Interpretations Committee was making was that the unilateral power to buy annuities without changing the pension promise is an investment decision, and that that is quite different from the power to wind up the plan by settling the liabilities through the purchase of annuities and then winding up the plan, but also from enhancing the benefits. Mm-hmm. And understand that that is something that will be made clear in the amendment to the interpretation.
Yes, absolutely.
So what kind of entities would typically be affected by this proposed change to IFRIC 14?
Some UK entities would be affected because some UK pension trustees can unilaterally decide to enhance benefits or to wind up a plan or a both at any time without an entity's consent, especially if the plans are closed to future accrual. Economic benefits are not available through reduction in future contributions, and thus the impact could be significant on some entities with closed plans. This issue does not exist in most jurisdictions because it is not common that third parties have such a unilateral power. An entity's approval or decision is necessary to change the pension promise in most jurisdictions.
Okay. So again, the focus is on does the trustee have the power to change the pension promise, and that's in particular where this potential or proposed amendment would have greatest impact.
Yes.
Okay. So what's the next step?
In this meeting, the Interpretations Committee concluded that the proposed amendment to IFRIC 14 should be separate from the annual improvements. the staff will present the interpretation committee's proposal to the ISB at a future meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, next we'll look at an item related to the application of IAS 28, Investments in Associates and Joint Ventures, and in particular, an item related to assessing the fund manager's significant influence over a fund. Now, Koichiro, could you please briefly explain what the issue is?
Right, Michael. The issue relates to the application of the equity method in accordance with IAS 28. Particularly, the issue relates to the assessment of a significant influence. When a fund manager has a direct holding in the fund it manages, but does not control it. The submitter described a specific situation on the issue. A fund manager has a direct holding in the fund. An assessment of a control under IFRS 10 concluded that the fund manager does not control the fund because the manager acts as an agent in accordance with the application guidance in IFRS 10. In this particular situation, the submitter raised two questions. One, whether the fund manager should assess if it has a significant influence over the fund. Two, if yes, how should it make the significant influence assessment?
Okay. Now, do we know if there's diversity on practice on this issue?
Yes, Michael. Before the Interpretations Committee meeting, we conducted outreach to the national standards setters, regulators, and accounting firms. The response to the outreach indicated that there are divergent views on the issue. Some respondents noted that the decision-making right of the fund manager is often limited by the terms of the fund, such as the case of an autopilot. They therefore concluded that such decision-making right does not generally constitute a significant influence. On the other hand, other respondents pointed out that it is difficult to say that the fund manager is not in a position to participate in the financial and operating policy decisions of the fund. Therefore, they thought that the fund manager would generally have significant influence.
Okay, so quite mixed views then from the outreach that we conducted.
Exactly.
Now, what was the committee's view on this issue?
Yes, Michael. In this meeting, the Interpretations Committee considered that the application guidance on IFRS 10 addressed the assessment of control. However, it does not affect the assessment of significant influence. When a fund manager is assessed as an agent in accordance with IFRS 10, such an assessment does not exempt the manager from considering whether it instead has significant influence. So the fund manager needs to make the separate assessment of significant influence in accordance with IAS 28. The committee also noted that IAS 28 does not directly address the issue of whether the fund manager should include its participation in financial and operating policy decisions that it undertakes on behalf of and for the benefit of others in its significant influence assessment. The committee considered that this issue would be better considered as a part of a wider review of the equity method of accounting. Consequently, the committee tentatively decided not to add this issue onto its agenda, but instead to recommend to the IASB that it should analyze and assess this issue in its research project on the equity method of accounting.
Okay, so I take from that that the key point is those powers to participate in the operating and financial decisions of the entity that the fund manager has in its capacity as agent for others, should those powers be included or excluded from the assessment of whether the agent has, the fund manager has, significant influence over the entity itself?
Exactly, thanks.
So what's the next step on this project?
Yes, this tentative agenda decision will be open for comment until November. The Interpretations Committee will discuss the comments received at the January 2015 meeting. We will also notify this issue to the Equity Method Research Project team.
Thank you. And the final issue to look at today relates to IFRS 12, which is the standard on disclosure of interests in other entities. And this particular issue is about disclosures for a subsidiary with a material non-controlling interest and for material joint ventures or associates. Now, Denise, could you briefly describe what the question was that was submitted to us?
Yes, sure, Michael. Well, the Interpretations Committee received a request to clarify the basis for the disclosures in paragraphs 12E to G of IFRS 12. These disclosures are for a subsidiary that has non-controlling interests that are material to the reporting entity. And the Interpretations Committee was also made aware of an additional concern on an issue relating to the disclosures required by paragraph 21BII, also in IFRS 12, but for joint ventures and associates.
And what is the main concern about the requirements in paragraphs 12E to G of IFRS 12 and paragraph 21BII?
Well, there seem to be divergent views about the basis on which these disclosures should be presented. So something that is information should be provided at the subsidiary level. So this means providing information for the legal entity and based on the separate financial statements of the individual subsidiary, whereas others think that this information should be provided at the subgroup level, and this meaning the material subsidiary together with its investees, and that this information should be based on the entity's consolidated financial statements. So this is a concern that was raised for paragraphs 12E to G. And then the additional concerns raised for paragraph 21BII, they are very similar, as I had mentioned. So for this disclosure, something that IFRS 12 does not specify the basis on which an entity should prepare the required summarized financial information for joint ventures and associates in accordance with this paragraph.
Okay. And what was the Interpretation Committee's view on the requirements in paragraphs 12E to G for a subsidiary that has a non-controlling a material non-controlling interest?
Well, the Interpretations Committee determined that the decision on which approach should be used to present the disclosures required by paragraph 12EG should reflect the one that best meets the disclosure objective in paragraph 10 of IFRS 12. And furthermore, for the disclosure required in paragraph 12G, the reporting entity should also make sure that the summarized financial information about the material subsidiary should enable users to understand the interest and non-controlling interests have in the group's activities and cash flows in accordance with paragraph B10B of IFRS 12. So Overall, what the Interpretations Committee observed is that the disclosures required in paragraphs 12E to G, first, they would be prepared from the perspective of the reporting entity, and second, the reporting entity would apply its judgment in determining whether this information should be provided for the subsidiary or the individual subsidiary, or alternatively, provide information for the subgroup of the subsidiary together with its investees. I would just like to note that if the information is provided for the subgroup, then only the transactions among the entities in the subgroup will be eliminated, and this is to meet the requirements in paragraph B11 of IFRS 12.
So I think the key takeaway from this is focus on the disclosure objective in paragraph 10 of IFRS 12. The information is prepared from the perspective of the reporting entity itself, but as to whether that's the separate subsidiary or the subsidiary subgroup is a matter of judgment as to what meets the disclosure objective best.
That's right, Michael.
And what was the Interpretation Committee's view on the requirements in paragraph 21BII for joint ventures and associates that are material to the reporting entity?
Well, in this case, the Interpretations Committee observed that the reporting entity should present the summarized financial information required for a joint venture or associate that is material based on the consolidated financial statements for the joint venture or associate if it has subsidiaries. If it does not have subsidiaries, then the presentation should be based on the financial statements of the joint venture or associate in which its own joint ventures or associates are equity accounted.
Okay. So what's the next step on this one?
Well, the Interpretations Committee decided to issue a tentative agenda decision that will be due for comment for 60 days. And then after that, we will bring back an agenda decision at a future meeting with the Interpretations Committee.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the IFRIC Update podcast for September 2014. The full details of the committee's meeting can be found in IFRIC Update newsletter, which is on the ISB website. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.